Hello, everybody, and welcome. I'm Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and I'm very excited to be here today for one of our Shine post-conference VIP bonus talks. And we have the privilege and the honor to have with us someone who is very, very well-versed in this whole gut-brain connection and is going to share her brilliance with us. Let me tell you a little bit about her, and then I'll tell you a little bit about the talk, and then I'm going to turn it over. We've got Dr. Martha Herbert, who's a pediatric neurologist. She's a brain researcher, a writer, a speaker, and an integrative systems thinker. She runs a research program called Transcend, and it's at the Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. And she's a faculty member there, where she co-directs the Body-Brain Resilience Center Clinic and Practice-Based Research Center. She's the author of the public-facing Harvard Health Publications book, The Autism Revolution. We want to hear more about that. And Whole Body System Strategies for Making Life All It Can Be. She's also the director of the Medical Advisory Board for the Documenting Hope Project. She got her medical degrees from Columbia University and her neurology training at Mass General in Boston. And before medical school, she received a PhD in the History of Consciousness program at the University of California in Santa Cruz. That's my old stomping ground. You can learn more about her. There's a link on the page, on the Shine page, where you can watch the recording when it's over as well. But it's www.marthaherbert.org. So I am so very excited to be here. You are, you know, so well trained and so well versed in this whole topic. Just a little background on our conference. So, you know, all of these folks are health practitioners who came to a conference that we held in the fall, which was on the gut-brain connection. And what we were giving them is like the postgraduate education. So after the conference, some of these wonderful talks. So I'm so honored to have you here today.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be able to share some of my thinking and work with an audience of clinicians whom I presume are likely to be bold and creative clinicians.
Yes, you're right. And we're clinicians in all different aspects. So some are MDs, some are DCs, some are acupuncturists, some are nutritionists, some have combinations of those kinds of degrees, some are health coaches. So there's a little physician's assistants, nurses. Hopefully I didn't leave anybody out, counselors. So people in different aspects of that health processing, where we all are committed to having an effect on people through the whole body connection versus just the this for that approach.
Right, absolutely. Really important.
Mm-hmm.
I am taking a bold approach to the gut-brain connection, adding planet in, because as all of us are more and more aware, the planet isn't doing very well. Many of our patients are not doing very well. There's a lot of chronic illness going on.
Yeah.
And I'm operating from the assumption that the chronic illness epidemics and the crisis of planetary health are really, really interrelated. Mm-hmm. And that's my premise in my Autism Revolution book. It's the premise of the movie Documenting Hope that I'm working on, where we're going to track recovery of children with complex illnesses, that we feel that the hope of recovering from complex illnesses on the human level, really recovering, not just managing symptoms, is based on taking a systems approach that's really similar to the kind of systems approach we need to take to try and stem the tide of what's going on with the planet. And so that's why I decided in the end to call my talk Gut, Brain, and Planet.
Nice.
Now, what do gut and brain have in common? So I'm basically more of a brain person in that I'm a pediatric neurologist, but 11 years ago I wrote a paper, Autism, a brain disorder or a disorder that affects the brain. and have been really interested in how the gut, the metabolism, the immune system shape the brain problems in so many chronic illnesses, neurodegenerative diseases, things which people consider primarily neurological, whole body conditions or systemic conditions where there are accompanying brain issues, attention, mood, and so forth. But when you begin to look, you see that the gut and the brain have things in common, and really it rests on what organisms have to do to nourish themselves and engage in information processing associated with regulating the organism and getting the organism, especially for animals where we have to move to get our food, unlike most, you know, plants. So we have communication, and these categories, some people will recognize them from functional medicine, but they're really basic things that have to go on in the brain and in the gut. There has to be communication, and communication requires healthy biological conditions. There has to be energy, and the gut needs energy for transport of substances, for peristalsis, and for much more, while the brain, which only weighs maybe 3 pounds, uses 20% of the body's energy. Cells have to replicate, even in the brain, where the established knowledge was that neurons don't replicate. Well, sometimes they do, and the glial cells replicate a lot. Repair, everything alive has to repair. Maintenance of structural integrity from the cellular level, like the membranes and the cytoskeleton, to the whole body. You produce waste, you've got to eliminate it. You got to protect and defend, and you got to transport and get things moved around. The gut has a nervous system, and this is a cartoon of the enteric nervous system. And Michael Gershon wrote a book some years ago. He's a physician at Columbia University and a scientist, called The Second Brain, about the brain of the gut. And this is well known by now. But look at all the different types of nerves and plexuses and so forth at every level that you can strip away of the gut. So, and the gut brain, the brain itself, I mean, we're talking a lot about microbiome. That's very, you know, in the spotlight these days. But certainly the chemical and other changes associated with the microbiome will interact with the nervous system of the gut. These are the housekeeping and trash collecting cells of the brain, glial cells. I didn't put in a slide that I should have in a way. For many years, glial cells have been considered the handmaidens of neurons. And there was a wonderful article in a Journal of Women's Studies on women in the brain, that the glial cells for many years were considered subordinate and talked about in the female gender, until they figured out that the glial cells are actively participating in signal generation, not just the neurons, and suddenly the gender started showing up in scientific papers as male. So I think that's kind of amusing and also sobering in terms of understanding the biases of how we think about our bodies. You know, for example, and this is a little diversionary, but assuming that the immune system wages war on evil germs is a common metaphor, but other people think that the immune system is a regulator of the microbiome ecosystem. And those are high-level generalizations that you can't prove with any one thing, but they will bias what you see and what you don't see. And right now, we're suffering harm from the idea that if someone has an infection, we have to nuke it repeatedly sometimes with antibiotics from all the people who have something that can be called the missing microbiome. But let's get back to the glia in our gut. in this picture, you see that even in a villus, the tiny little mini finger-like structures around which absorption occurs, the glial cells extend from the base of the glia all the way to the tip. So there's nervous system involvement in very, very intimately connected with the other sort of more widely thought of and commonly thought of activities of the gut, namely digesting and absorbing food. I just want to pitch this wonderful book about glial cells, The Other Brain, by Doug Fields, who was an early appreciator of the incredible role of glial cells, which in the brain and gut outnumber neurons either from, depending on where you are, 4-to-1 to 10-to-1. So what we've been missing is quite remarkable. Oh, well, look at this. Here's women in the brain, what I just finished telling you about, a history of glial cell metaphors. Again, the metaphors clearly imply that as cells become more valuable to the nervous system function, they become metaphorically masculine. One of the things that's becoming more and more discussed in scientific research for perhaps even the last 10 years or even somewhat less is what I would metaphorically call the rivers and the wetlands of the brain. Look at these beautiful wetlands. You see bodies of water interacting with semi-solid and solid soil, and plants are growing. As you dive into the microscopic level, you have very, very rich and complex interactions between surfaces of minerals and biofilms and water full of ions and, again, dissolved substances, and an amazing exchange and filtration process takes place. And I want to call your attention to it because it's really nice to zoom out from one particular part of the body, like in this case, the gut, and see that there are fundamental biological, or let me call them biophysical, principles that underlie living activity, whether it's in the gut or in an ecosystem. And also, what I've been really learning, which I'll get to in just a minute, that this is very important in the brain, and that's why I'm bringing it up, because I'm at the part here talking about commonalities between gut and brain. Unfortunately, many wetlands look like this. It's really heartbreaking. It's garbage. It's disruption. It's interference. It's neglect. It's junkyards. I remember 25 years ago spending a week in a remote part of the Yucatan on the Atlantic. Nobody was there for miles in either direction, and the beach was covered with washed up plastic. And now they're predicting that the plastic in the ocean will exceed the volume of fish by 2050. So this is what we're doing to our planet, and I'll get back to that in a little while. Let me move ahead to the brain, and I was telling you about glial cells. Astrocytes are a kind of glial cell, and the brain has fluids. The brain, in addition to the blood flow, has cerebrospinal fluid in large bodies and also in little channels inside the brain. And as I was saying earlier, when you have waste, you've got to move it out. They have now discovered these, what they've called glymphatics, glial lymph-like pathways. They're not exactly lymph, and there is more on lymph, but which allow the clearance of things that accumulate during a day's work that the brain performs while we're awake. And one thing that happens is that the brain actually produces misfolded proteins. It's just part of metabolism. And in the night, the cells, the astrocytes will shrink down. In the night, I won't say night, but when you're sleeping, the cells will shrink down. They have end feet. You can see a little bit of it in the picture around the capillaries of the brain. And more space opens up around the blood vessels where this fluid can carry out waste products. And what we've been coming to realize is that the buildup of misfolded proteins that's so well known, say, for example, in Alzheimer's, and also goes on in other diseases of neurodegenerative diseases, may not even necessarily be a problem of things being produced when they shouldn't be, but it may be a drainage problem, a problem of these things piling up when they should be eliminated. And of course, I don't have to really, it's not at all a stretch to compare that to the gut, because one of the major activities of the gut is elimination of waste. So brain's waste management systems. Years ago, I was spending a lot of time talking to a neurotoxicologist named Mickey Ashner, who's done a lot of work on astrocytes and toxicity. Astrocytes are the garbage collectors of the brain. They sequester toxins and heavy metals to protect the rest of the brain environment and to protect the neurons from damage. Of course, they can only sequester so much. And if they are not relieved of what they've piled up, the dysfunction in them will leave the brain in a state of neglect regarding the cleanup operations and other services that astrocytes provide. So a while ago, I was really interested in this idea, and I found some not very well known, but really amazing papers from Romania, where they were trialing nutritionally intense programs to see on rodents to see if they could improve brain health even in the setting of serious brain disease. And this is a picture here. So what, there was a very high nutrient support was given to these animals, and the animals already had advanced neurodegenerative disease. And in the left-hand picture, where I say collecting the trash, you see these glial cells with all this white stuff in it. That white stuff is misfolded proteins such as lipofuscin that have been phagocytosed, eaten up by these glial cells. So they're collecting the trash. In the second, the second number two, taking it to the curb, which is a blood vessel, that should be directly under number two. So you can see this basically trash-filled glial cell sidling up to the sidewalk, to the curb. And in number three, you see that a glial cell similarly filled up with trash is dumping its trash into a blood vessel to be washed out of there and eliminated, perhaps even transported to the gut to be extruded and included in the solid waste disposal. That's pretty remarkable to see that it's not just the major organs of elimination that take out the trash, but that it's something not only that's necessary, but that can be supported by enhanced nutrition, even in the brain. So brain waste management depends on gut nutrient supply and absorption. And here we know that we're in a kind of a state of crisis, because many people are eating what this little fake news article in The Onion, which is a satirical newspaper, probably many or most of you know of it, kind of like Jon Stewart online, but predating him. And here's an old article from them. McDonald's stock slides as more consumers turn to food, of course implying that McDonald's doesn't serve food. That's the humor. The picture on the right of Ronald McDonald doing namaste is actually not from the Onion article, but I took that myself in Chiang Mai in the airport last summer. I had seen it in Bangkok some years ago. So they actually remodeled Ronald McDonald so that he would look like he was giving a Buddhist namaste greeting, and he looks unusually compassionate in his face. I just think that's a remarkable level to which we will go to sell what the article calls quasi-food to people who actually have beautiful food traditions that this is displacing. So this type of junk food, I would argue, interferes with the nutrient supply that the body and, now you know, the brain need to conduct proper waste management. And this is part of our crisis. And if you keep eating that stuff, you'll look like Ronald McDonald here. So when I talk about the planetary crisis, let me call your attention to a report. I'm sorry, my formatting is a little off here. Again, it must have been the transfer. The United Nations put out a report in 2006, State of the Planet. They said in their executive summary, ecosystem damage is so severe that we can no longer be confident that the planet Earth can support human life for more than two generations. And then I put in a picture from an article by Wendell Berry, who's an environmental philosopher and poet. Our national faith has always been, there's always more. Our true religion is a sort of autistic industrialism. And one of the features of autism is repetitive and restrictive behavior. So here we see a kind of a lining up cars that some people with autism do, but here in a junkyard, done by people who probably are not diagnosed with autism, but are still, we engage in this repetitive consumerism that isn't necessarily nourishing and also depletes vital resources. And this one is something where Al Gore is being made into Superman's father, and Al Gore places his infant son in a rocket to escape a dying planet. I have to say, I never thought of Al Gore looking like Superman's father until I saw this picture. The thing is, we have no other planet to go to. Now, let me tell you about the delicate and critical biophysical features of gut and brain. And when I say biophysical, I'm moving down underneath metabolism. Metabolism is organized chemical activity, or at least that's the way I'm using the word. There are pathways. We have known reactions and transformations. But at the biophysical level, it isn't structured in that same kind of pathway, structured chemical way. The brain has a whole biophysical basis to it that is just starting to be more importantly on the radar screen. It consists of what the pictures are showing is the extracellular space and also the extracellular matrix. So the top picture, the top left, the blue areas are the space between the cells, and the yellow and orange things are the neurons and glial cells. The extracellular space in the brain, and think back to those rivulets in the wetlands, it takes up about 20% of the brain's volume, believe it or not. And inside that space, there are an abundance of substances that serve functions prominently including filtration. And if you think about it, there are many different features of that system that are vulnerable to doing worse or possibly better. So let me go down toward the bottom of the list. Let me start from the bottom and go up. Viscosity. See that the extracellular space is between the round thing on the bottom and the thing above it, then that's a space of a synapse. If the fluid in that space is more sticky, the neurotransmitters will have a harder time getting across the space. If the pH, the acidity, the measure of acidity, if the pH is more acidic versus more alkaline, it will also affect the activities of the brain. You can actually measure brain pH using a non-invasive brain imaging technique, a variant of spectroscopy called phosphorus spectroscopy. And a researcher at Harvard Medical School a couple of years ago at McLean Hospital had the interesting idea of studying this measure among other related measures that you can get, because phosphorus spectroscopy measures bioenergetic compounds. It's related to energetic and mitochondrial metabolism. But he calculated the body mass index, the BMI, of a series of patients with psychosis whom he studied, and he found the higher the BMI, the more toward obese the people were, the lower the pH in the brain. I don't know if that's been reported before, but it is an indicator that poorer brain body health is accompanied by changes, which we may have ways of regulating and influencing through basic lifestyle interventions, like eating a more alkaline-promoting diet and being more hydrated and having a good supply of minerals so that the filtration system keeps working. And this is a foundational piece of the brain as a living organism that, in a way, the spirit of the emergence of gut health encourages us to think in similar ways about the brain. When we have oxidative stress, inflammation, toxic influences, remember that we have injury at the cellular level. And this is a diagram I got some years ago from Jill James, who's an outstanding contributor to oxidative stress understandings in autism and Down syndrome and other conditions. You get protein damage, and we already talked about misfolded proteins being taken out of the brain. You get membrane damage. You get membrane damage both in the cell membrane and the organelle membranes of the organelles inside the cell. DNA gets damaged. The membrane leaks. Substances like calcium don't stay where they belong, but go to places where they can be more harmful. So this kind of injury at the cellular level propagates in the cells and can be encouraged by a poor state of health and pH and viscosity and so forth of the extracellular space. Now, I already talked again about this is the unhealthy wetlands of our planet, and what I'm trying to imply to you is that these wetlands are also a metaphor for the extracellular space in the brain, and we can have healthy wetlands or we can have sick wetlands. And a lot of it is our choice from the lifestyle emphases that we have as to whether they're health promoting or health or sickness promoting. Malfunctions of gut and brain. Sewage backup in the gut and the brain is something that we're talking about. I already showed you that these misfolded proteins could be removed in the brain, and I told you about the glymphatic pathway function. Here you can see that Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and Huntington's are proteinopathies involving a pileup of misfolded or aggregated intracellular or extracellular proteins. In order to remove these soluble amyloid beta and other proteins, you need a functioning drainage system, which means you need to get enough sleep, because this kind of drainage occurs much more at night. Now, I started studying large brains in autism a long time ago, probably 14 years ago, and since then, it's been identified as a problem in a subset of people with autism, and people have looked for genes or a buildup, a failure to prune down the neurons in brain development. But with this kind of information, it makes me wonder whether we might not have a fluid backup situation. And those of you familiar with autism will know that many, many people with autism have serious sleep problems, and which then get imposed on their whole family. And the failure to sleep well may be one contributor, along with other metabolic and immune derangements, to a pileup of things rather than a neuron, an axon-based alteration of volume. And actually, the studies of the brain using proxy measures are not supportive of these large brains being from more neurons and more axons. Let me just talk for a bit about coral reefs. My colleague in Shanghai, Liping Zhao, who's a major microbiome researcher, who was senior author on a recent paper in Nature about the need for international cooperation in the global microbiome, said to me that coral reefs are like the gut turned inside out. They have all kinds of microflora, they have biofilms, they're very sensitive to pH and the fluids and so forth. And basically, unfortunately, the projection is that the coral reefs on our planet will be dead in 25 years. That's a really painful thing. If you look at the top left, you see this gorgeous, beautiful wonderland of a thriving coral reef. And on the right, you see a different coral reef in a state of death. And on the bottom, a less vivid picture, but it's the same place before, when the coral reef was viable, and after, when it was blanched out. This, in a way, is a metaphor for what's going on in the fluid channels within our own bodies as gut health deteriorates. And as we learn the ways to restore healthy microbiome diversity, healthy, we stop going in such an acid direction, and so many more things for health, and we quit doing things, even as simple as skin diving over coral reefs, wearing a sun protectant can be bad for coral reefs. We need to go aggressively in a health-promoting way, and that applies to our health, and that applies to our planet. So this is the quote that I just said. Coral reefs are like our intestines turned inside out. So what I think we're dealing with is short-sighted brains and foolish management of human waste products. And this is, these are really, the short-sighted brains are a major problem in everything, because otherwise we wouldn't be so destructive, and we wouldn't either of the planet or ourselves. Let me introduce you to a concept which you may already be familiar with, but if you're not, it's really important. We currently deal with human waste products by flushing them away and not thinking about them anymore. What's really scary about that is, in addition, what we do is we mix these waste products with chemical and industrial waste. Now, the waste products from human beings contain, as we're more and more appreciating, trillions of organisms of many, at least thousands of types, with many different metabolic activities. When you mix them with industrial waste, you put incredible selection pressures on these organisms. And they're going to start swapping genes like crazy to protect themselves from the toxic pressures to which they're being subjected, it's very concerning to think of how in this way we may be driving organisms to chemical and antibiotic and heavy metal resistance. And yet it's surprising how little the topic of the way we handle our solid wastes is on the environmental agenda. So how are crazy ideas about human waste, which is what our guts produce? So our brain has crazy ideas of what's coming out of our bodies, and these crazy ideas are contributing to destroying the planet. As I already said, the planet is not stable. And what we really need to be thinking about is whether the bugs are our enemies or whether that's a confused narrative. And I already brought this up before. So let me continue with the, what we've been doing in our management of microorganisms actually is both disturbing their biology and making them having to adopt stances that probably weren't necessary before, because we're exposing them to new to nature chemicals that they never had to respond to, and especially not in such volume and intensity. We are in a broad way. This is another brilliant piece from The Onion. This is an oldie but goodie. Consumer product diversity now exceeds biodiversity. Honestly, this sums things up in a painful kind of way. But they make a sardonic argument that, after all, even though we have less biodiversity, we can be thankful for all the new products that we have on the market. What we need to be doing for our guts, for our microbiome, and for our planet is to move from carpet bombing microorganisms to rebalancing antibiotics. And I have here Beyond Antibiotics and a very interesting book by a leading researcher and scholar in this field, Stephen Harrod Buhner. I should also have said Beyond Pesticides, because it is possible to manage pests with intelligent ecosystem management, and it's something that was well understood in many traditional agricultural practices around the world, and some researchers are going and working to retrain people to go back to the way their grandparents did it and allow for the interplay of organisms to maintain some kind of a balance, instead of making an executive decision about which ones are important and which ones are enemies of what we call important, which probably is mostly an economic decision and not a scientific decision. We need to be able to support the balance in organisms, including but not limited to microorganisms in ecosystems. So source separation of waste is something that I really think that people serious about gut health and microbiome health on the human and planetary level need to rise to the occasion and take seriously. And source separation, and I hope you can read this, is something that you can do through compost toilets and gray water technologies, which represent a key concept for rational environmental behavior. By keeping large amounts of water and all commercial, industrial, and household toxics separately from our body's excreta from the gut and urinary waste products, what we open up is a much richer recycling of nutrients. Nutrients in excreta become available for sustainable reuse in agriculture. By returning these nutrients to agriculture, we can reduce the use of fossil fuel, which is a major ingredient in the production of chemical fertilizer. So if we don't need the chemical fertilizer, we take away the need to use it to create chemical fertilizer because we're recycling our own excreta in the way they always would have been in nature, but we're doing it in a more carefully organized way. We also broaden the spectrum of available plant nutrients. Healthful food requires all the nutrients plants need, not just nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus, which are the only constituents of chemical fertilizers. And there's a very striking comment in a book on detox I read a few years ago that many of us are trying to reduce our body's inflammation by eating lots of vegetables. But if the way we fertilize these vegetables through a limited supply of nutrients like just nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus, but not all the myriad zinc and magnesium, selenium, and molybdenum, and all these things that we need in various kinds of levels to conduct our metabolic biochemistry and the biophysical activities of our organisms, we have actually been eating plants that are inflamed because they themselves are deprived of these nutrients, and we're trying to get better from our own inflammation by using plants that are not healthy enough and that actually could be considered inflamed themselves. So secondly, keeping toxic substances out of excreta makes it possible to reconsider their role in manufacturing. If industry became responsible for the disposal of the toxic substances it uses, rather than just dumping them in the nearest river or lake, which is where we are having so many problems now, it could either use them in a closed-loop system or find less harmful alternative substances. If alternative substances are not possible, then a decision can be made about whether the use of toxics is to be continued. And if this decision could be made with the participation of all those potentially affected by it. So at the moment, the decision is made mostly surreptitiously, thanks to the mostly unregulated opportunity for industry to use the sewer as a low-cost dump. But what I'm saying to you is that this is really important for the planetary microbiome, which we should be aware by now filters back into us and is probably one of the contributors to our own ill health. And here are some resources that you can look at about thinking about learning more about expanding your thinking about human excreta from a human health issue to an agriculture and planetary issue. And the Clevis Multrum Company is a early pioneer in composting toilets. So what I think we need in order to preserve and recover our health, this is a foundation, this is my foundation, but I want to read to you the mission. I really think that what I'm trying to say in this talk is that what it says in the bullet points, that we are finding similarities in practices across different domains. We are finding recoveries and remissions from complex, supposedly incurable health problems like autism, autoimmune disease, brain injury, and cancer. And this is what we're working on for children in our film, The Documenting Hope Project. People are greatly improving food quality. God bless the foodies and all the careful renewal of organic and biodynamic agricultural practices, and we're restoring biodiversity and stability in ecosystems, not on a big enough scale, but it is being done. And what I highlight in green is that there appear to be common conceptual processes and process threads across these practices, which are often practices that are generated locally, indigenously, through networks, and or in community-based participatory fashion. These approaches to complex health and environmental challenges are helping parts of our planet and some of its inhabitants to get better, even while many other things get worse. So I am offering to you gut, brain, and planet as a metaphor when you start to see these relationships in how the biology works and in what we need to do at each and all of these three levels. You can start to expand your perspective from the health just of the body to the health and creative and problem-solving functions and transcendent functions of the brain and the transforming the trajectory of our planet into one more healthful. So I hope I've given you some helpful information, some novel perspectives for you in expanding the way you think about this, and things to dream and think and read about as you go forward. And thank you.
Thank you so very much. That was very, very enlightening. And I loved how you made those connections across the different systems. Really, really awesome stuff. And I know that people have some questions, so I want to let people know how they can ask you questions while we still have you live on the line. So if you're on the call, it's a star 2 to raise your hand. And you can, I'll open up your line and you can ask Dr. Herbert a question. And then if you're on the web, you can either type it into the question box, which is somewhere around where you're watching the slides, or you can do it on the Join Me chat, which link is in your email. Yeah.
Will you read the questions to me, or do I need to find them?
No, I will read the questions to you. We have someone with a hand up, so I'll just open up her line. Go ahead, Lynn.
I really want to appreciate, I already appreciate, I want to tell you how much I appreciate this call and the things that you have to say. I practice many of the biodynamic principles on, I have about 4 acres, and so I already am practicing some of those, and we have an old farmhouse, and we're looking at turning our system into a dry toilet composting system as well. And so just hearing the things that you have to say here, I really truly appreciate that. Unfortunately, I live along the Minnesota-Iowa border and I'm surrounded by conventional farmers, both livestock as well as plants. And they're all conventional GMO, spray everything down. I always joke there's more pigs in hog confinements than people in houses. But I say the word organic and they go cross-eyed. So I guess that's my long-winded way of saying how much I appreciate what you're sharing here. And it gives me more information to share with people so that they understand what they're doing, not only to their own bodies, but to this planet.
Yeah, so. You know, I just want to say, I actually own a farm myself. I inherited it. I actually have one last slide. I just put it up on the screen. I inherited it from my father. He died quite a while ago, but I watched the area go from a series of lovely, flourishing small farms to their being really attacked, and a lot of the farmers on our road committing suicide. But now, in more recent years, some of the people are going back to being organic and finding it such a relief. So I feel like we have a lot of work to do. It's an uphill battle in the sense that the vast majority of government money is going to the conventional industrial model. And that goes for what we do in healthcare and what we do in agriculture. And we just need to make a change. So thank you for your comment.
Absolutely. And thank you for, you know, we're all part of this grassroots effort to say enough's enough. This isn't how we want to feed ourselves or our planet. This is not how we should be taking care of ourselves or our planet. And the more of us speak up, we may think we're just one voice, but every voice adds to. And we all as individuals can talk to many people. And in a position like you're in, where you're making a film and you're speaking, you're working in medical institutions where you can make the traditional medical, or I would say conventional medical people are into that practice are hearing your voice of reason and wisdom. And it's just wherever we go, we just have to speak, not by preaching, but by just speaking and allowing the knowledge to come through. Because a lot of decisions, I think, are made from ignorance. Granted, a lot of them are not made from ignorance. They're profit driven, and like, you know, the Monsantos and the various drug companies don't want to hear that there's an alternative because it doesn't add to their bottom line. But the truth of the matter is that probably the majority of people, I would venture to say, a lot of it is ignorance. And it's us being able to open up their minds and hearts and the knowledge to these facts that are so blatant. When you look at the pictures, it's so sad when you look at the pictures and then think about the coral reef being gone in 25 years. Holy cow. Like, for what reason are we doing this? So keep being that voice of reason. I can't wait to find out more about your Hope Project film, because I think that's going to be a big eye opener, and people really pay attention when there's stuff like that around.
Yeah. Thanks very much.
Yeah. Yeah, it was amazing. And the whole glial cell, the garbage dump, like really visualizing that and seeing that, very eye-opening.
Great.
I'm going to go over to the questions and see who has any questions. There are a few people that, well, actually one person who typed a bunch of questions in advance. I don't know if she's on the call. And maybe these aren't all appropriate to, oh, it looks like she just typed the same question in over and over like 17 times. So maybe an important question for her to get answered. She said, other than movement meditation, fermented foods, cultured veggies, bone broth, asparagus, artichokes, leeks, and vegetables in general, is there something else our good bacteria thrive on?
That's a very, obviously starches and prebiotics and so forth.
Yeah.
But I think another level that I've experienced myself, and I hope you're not getting an echo, but I am, is transformative experiences that reframe things that are causing you stress so that you have a much richer appreciation of yourself or some situation. I have found from personal experience, and I've heard this from doctors and others, and that you can transform gut health from top down as well. I've been studying with Anat Baniel, studying neuromovement, and she finds that even for patients who come in who have gut problems, including but not limited to the autism spectrum, gut health can improve even when you're not doing more or less of any of that, due to, I think, in that case, sort of a more of a sense of self and agency in the world, which means less stress. So I think it's all of the physical things are really important, but if you're still walking around in a lot of stress and tension and contradictions and negative ruminations, that will all be an obstacle. Whereas if you shift all of that in a healthier and more affirming and positive and higher energy, lighter energy level, that can help your gut too. So it needs to be remembered. And that's also the gut-brain thing, to remember that.
Right. I totally agree with that, because we're always, a lot of times we're looking for, okay, let's find that superfood or super nutrient or super probiotic that's going to change it all. But it has to be a full system approach. Otherwise, you're fermenting in this negative energy soup that gets secreted when we're running around with cortisol dominating our system.
Yeah.
Yeah, she also asks if you want to tell in which order these are important. Hydration for the brain, hydration, healthy fats, intermittent fasting, or a healthy gut. Do you have a particular order, or they stay equally important in your eyes?
Hydration is critical for everything.
Right.
The fats are really, really important. I can't recommend. I don't think intermittent fasting is something for everyone. It's something for people who have the stamina and stability to do it. mm-hmm. but not for people who don't. And I forgot what the fourth one was.
Healthy gut.
Oh, a healthy gut. Well, I do consulting for the Center for Discovery, which is a large residential facility in the Catskills in New York State that has the largest in the state, the largest in terms of numbers of people, and they have a 66-acre biodynamic farm. And they've brought in researchers, including me, to try and figure out how to study this. So we're studying the brain, we're studying the nutrition, we're studying the exercise, sleep. And so people will say, well, which one of those is helping these people the most? And I'm like, that's not the right question.
Yeah.
Because optimization of health requires optimization across dimensions.
Right.
And the idea that that if you do one or two, that's okay, and you don't need to do the others. Well, maybe they will be helpful, but they're less helpful
yep.
than if you make every choice a healthy choice.
Exactly. I totally agree with that, and I've seen that happen over and over when we have, like, for example, we're working with people on insulin resistance and getting their blood sugar balance. Some of them think that as long as they eat the right foods and stay away from the sugars, that's going to fix it. But if they're not sleeping, if they're stressed out, if they're timing their foods incorrectly, if they're not working out, and there's other factors, their environment is polluted, it's not going to really do what it could do. It may not even make a dent, so to speak, depending on where the biggest stressor is for that person. So I am totally on board with that. It's a package deal, and you
right.
can't just pick and choose the ones that you think are going to be the easiest. So same thing in the soil environment, right? If you say,
yeah.
look, you plants, I'm going to give you all these nutrients that you need, but you know, we're in a drought here, so we're just not going to water you for a while. Or, you know, we don't have access to sun here because we're on the moon. You know, you can't take away critical components for life and expect life to optimize itself or the body to
yeah.
optimize itself.
Well, let me give you an example. There was a paper a year and a half ago by Dale Bredesen, Bredesen, about reversing mild cognitive impairment in 10 out of 11 cases, meticulous case histories of a complex nutritional, lifestyle, sleep, spiritual intervention with a bunch of supplements and other things. And people said, well, that's nice, but it's not evidence-based. Well, evidence, first of all, evidence includes case studies, but really I want to call your attention to a relevant metaphor that Dr. Bredesen uses, which is if you have a roof with 36 holes in it, the leaking won't stop until you patch all 36 holes.
Right.
So that's the way it is. And I think that, you know, one of the reasons people don't like that kind of research is that, you know, people have this notion of clean research where you just show a single relationship really well, but that's not the way the world works. If we worked one thing at a time, there would be no life on Earth. Life is based on complexity.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that because we want to look at it as a this for that approach. Like, what's the most important thing? It's this one. Okay, so I'm just going to focus on this one and forget about the others because it's convenient for me to focus on the movement, but it's not convenient for me to focus on, you know, the stress or whatever. And I love what you said about the holes. And yeah, if there was a huge boulder size hole and then a bunch of other pinholes, you're going to see major improvement when you focus on the big hole. But the leak's still going to happen through the smaller holes. It just won't be as dramatic. And that's what happens when we look at somebody and identify, okay, here's some of the places where they have these big holes in their health or in their farm, for example. These are the places where they have their big holes. Let's patch up the biggest one first because they're going to see the most improvement. But you have to go back and patch the rest of them or
right.
you're still going to leak.
And not only that, but they'll get bigger.
They'll get bigger. That's
and not
right.
only that, they'll cause mold on the stuff on the inside to stretch the metaphor.
Yes, to stretch the metaphor. I like that. And I like the fact that they will get bigger because if you're not doing anything to correct why those holes got there in the first place, they're going to get bigger. Absolutely. So it's a short-sighted approach to just approach one thing. Sometimes as clinicians, we use that approach when we're dealing with somebody who is very reticent to make any changes at all. You find the one that's going to give them the biggest bang, and then you say, look, how would you like to go all the way here? Let's do another one and then another one. And eventually when they patch all the holes, that's when they're really healthy. And that's where when I see a lot of folks who come to me are they've quote unquote done it all, right? They've done this and they've done that and they've done acupuncture and they've done all kinds of other therapies. And they say, why isn't this getting better? And then when we look at it, there could be even a genetic factor that says that this certain thing they're eating or thing they're doing isn't congruent with their body. It's a stress on their body. And it's really a matter of being those detectives that help to find all the holes. I love the roof analogy. I'm going to use that because you're going to find all the holes and plug up all the holes. And that's when the person gets well. And if these people who say they've done it all, they're eating a clean diet, quote unquote, maybe not perfect for their physiology, but they're basically walking around with maybe 75% of the holes fixed. And our job is to find those other 25% of the holes and patch them up.
Right.
Fix them. Thank you. That's great. I love that analogy. Anybody else has a question, go ahead and do a *2 on your telephone. I'll check to see if there are any others typed in. And then, Lynn, I don't have the – I'm having trouble getting the Join Me chat open, so I don't know if there's any on there. But if there are, go ahead and read them for me. I'll open up your line, but I don't see any over there. Okay. Let me see. Refresh. I don't see any questions, and I don't see any more hands. So I guess we'll end it there. So, you know, I so appreciate your way of approaching things, and it's just so rewarding and refreshing to see someone of your caliber in the medical, the conventional medical standing, you know, having these positions at top medical institutions and being a neurology and pediatric neurologist. I mean, you're in a position where you have a lot of people that you can influence. I'm sure you get a lot of flack too for your attitudes and approaches as well, but you've got the strength and the stamina to keep going because you believe that what you're doing and what you're teaching is the answer to the future of our planet and of our health. So I applaud you for that.
Thank you so much. And thank you for your work too. I really am grateful.
Thank you so much. And so how we reach you is MarthaHerbert.com. Oh, .net, right?
No. Martha Herbert. Let's see. You can go MarthaHerbertMD@gmail.com.
MarthaHerbertMD@gmail.com. And how do we find out more and get in the loop for knowing about your film that you're making?
So DocumentingHope.com.
Okay. So DocumentingHope.com. And
yes, and we have a nice trailer on there. You really should watch it. It's lovely, 6 or 7 minutes.
Oh.
Go all the way to the end. After the typeface comes up again, then wait a little bit more. There's one more great, great part.
Oh, okay, DocumentingHope.com. And when is that going to be coming out, Martha?
We are building the infrastructure so we can pull the trigger. I'm hoping we're going to start filming. We're not filming because what we're doing is creating the data capture infrastructure so that everybody will be able to be tracked in a complex way. And I think this is the year we're going to actually pull the trigger because we've got the bulk of it, you know, really figured out really nicely, because we have to have absolutely everything in place. We're not just filming piecemeal. We're doing documentary and we're doing laboratory tests and we're lining it all up. It's quite a complex. I don't think anybody has done a prospective recovery study like this.
Wow.
We're recovering people, but we don't document it. And in order to really show that recovery is something we can do, we've got to document it.
Yeah.
So we're really trying to do it in a rigorous, high-end way, not just a casual way.
That's awesome. And I'd love to go ahead.
And I just wanted to mention, I have a clinic, bodybrainresilience.com, and that's also, people can look at that website, bodybrainresilience.com.
And is that something where people who are local to you in Massachusetts can go to, or is it something where you service people via Skype or whatever? Long distance.
Well, I mainly do because of legal reasons. We're required to see people in person at least once a year. But if people want to come from a distance, there are some of the services that we have that require hands-on that they won't be able to get, but there are other ones that don't.
Very good. Wow. Thank you so very much for all the work you're doing, for the impact that you're having on shifting our healthcare paradigm, and in just helping so many people around with all the work that you're doing. So thank you so much for being here.
You too. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye.